Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Áine Curry sitting in for Brendan now for something a little bit different. Fresh from his nearly complete 3-week motorbike tour of Ireland, comedian John Bishop, good afternoon and very welcome. You've parked the bike. You literally just took off the biker jacket here in studio. The bike is downstairs because you've come from Wexford via Tala this morning. Is this how you always travel now, motorbike?
No, this is the first time I've ever toured on a motorbike. And it's all part of a culmination of a midlife crisis, I suppose. So I decided to tour on a motorbike, and I decided I wanted to do it in Ireland because I wanted to do the Wild Atlantic Way. So that's what I've spent 3 weeks doing.
And why the motorbike? How did the inspiration come from doing that versus, you know, a nice scooter or travelling by car or running?
Well, because, as I say, it's a midlife crisis. So it was a motorbike or a 25-year-old stripper. So I thought the motorbike would be better.
Your wife was very firm.
Yeah,
yes,
the motorbike seemed the cheaper option. No, in all honesty, I've never been interested in riding a motorbike before, and then my father-in-law died and left me a scooter, but he left it in Brittany in France, so I had the idea of bringing that back to England, which I can't do now because of Brexit and all of the complications of that, and then so I ended up taking it to Barcelona on a ferry to Mallorca, where I've got a place. So that ride was the inspiration, because I'd never been on a motorbike, you know, so I was basically...
So you're a learner driver doing your test at some point last year, were you?
Exactly. So I rode all the way through France in the Pyrenees, dressed like I was nipping out for a baguette, because I had none of the proper gear. And I met some fellas on big BMW motorbikes, and I thought, that's what I want to do it properly.
And so you've got the gear now, as we can see, and you've got the motorbike. And so you decided to do Atlantic Way. You've been all across the country. I think you've called it a love letter to Ireland. So you've been Belfast, Derry, Letterkenny, Belmullet, Limerick, Killarney, Clonakilty, Cork, Wexford, Dublin. I think I've covered everyone
in
there.
You missed Clifton.
Oh, right, in Clare. Beautiful. Yeah. What's been the highlights? Like, what a way to travel and see this country. And you've probably even gotten some of our rare sunshine.
It's been amazing. The last couple of weeks, the weather has been fantastic. I've seen Irish people sunbathing in Ireland. I don't think anyone's seen that for a long time.
Yeah, we get a glimpse of the sun and it's barbecues out and shorts and we go
so
for it.
So it's been, because obviously on the west coast, the beaches, the area is beautiful to see. And to ride on a motorbike through some of it has been breathtaking.
And what's the experience? What's different about experiencing a country like this, but on a motorbike?
Well, for a start, and I have to say this, your roads are brilliant.
Oh.
I mean, honestly, you've got
parts of the country will disagree,
I'd say to them, go on the M25, because honestly, you've got potholes everywhere in England, and it's the roads are fantastic. I love the fact that you've got a road, and next to the road, you have that spare road as well. You have that little yellow dotted line, just in case somebody wants a bit more extra road. So you've got that. The network's fantastic in terms of the way it's all linked up. And I think from an experience point of view, when you're on a motorbike, you're more exposed to the environment. So, you know, there's good and bad in that, obviously, in Ireland. So there's a few wet days. But it's just, I don't know, it's just a different world.
Were you conscious of elections happening here over the last while you were travelling around?
Oh, cool. Well, we're across the border and I saw all the heads, all the faces on the lamppost. To be honest, my first impression was Tinder in Ireland's rubbish. And then
you were adjudicating all the candidates.
I was just looking at them, and then I thought, and then I realised that it was the election. Then I looked at it and thought, you've got no sense of anyone's policies, just that they've got a head.
Yeah.
So it's like, if you want to be in politics in Ireland, your first qualification is have a head and then get a photograph of that head and then put it on a poster and that's it. If people like your head, you're in.
So very different to how you see it going down in the UK. And what about Irish people's sense of humour? And like you've been to Ireland many times over the years, but is there something uniquely different about Irish audiences and the stories you tell? how you tell them, how they resonate with an Irish person.
You know what? And this is honestly true. And this is why this tour has become a love letter to Ireland, because the reality is that I kind of made the decision to be a professional comedian from doing gigs in Ireland. Just because my style of comedy is anecdotal, it's storytelling, and they like, you know, Irish people have always, they want you to have a story and they want you to have a song. and I can't sing, so I've got the stories, and that's...
And you've taken the bike onto stage as well, just for...
Oh, I did in Cork. I did the marquee in Cork, you know. The night before, I'd done the Barras in Clonakilty with 150 people in a pub. I never took the bike in there.
But to execute taking a bike on.
The marquee in Cork has 4,000 people in it, a big stage, and in my head, it was a brilliant idea. Until you're doing it and it's full of 4,000 people. And as I come on, I thought, this will be on the news tomorrow. One little slip and I've become Evel Knievel.
You pulled it off, though. Looked pretty smooth. Yeah, and you did the gig afterwards. You talked there about, you know, making your break in Ireland. Before, of course, you got into comedy, you worked in pharma sales. I think technically you've still been longer in pharma sales than you have been a comedian.
It's crossing over, yeah. I was in pharmaceuticals for 17 years. Wow. And I left my job at 14, 57 now, so I'm 17 years now as a professional comedian.
And is there anything applicable from pharmaceutical sales to life as a comedian? Any crossover skills, strengths?
Travel. Okay. Travel, that's it. Travel and that's about it, really. Because the job that I did was very specialised. We used to sell a drug that stopped people rejecting their organs after transplantation.
Okay.
And not very funny.
And you, over time, though, decided comedy was going to be for you. And I think a lot of listeners won't know how you came to fall into comedy at age 35. Will you bring us back to the story of, you know, you're going through a tricky period in your life, I seem to recall, separated from your wife at that particular period, and these kind of lonely Monday nights and how to fill them?
Well, that's it. That's basically it. I split up with my wife and then I had the kid because of the job that I had, because I was travelling all the time. I couldn't guarantee when I could have the kids in the week. So I had them every weekend, which meant Monday was a depressing time. So I was always looking for something to do on a Monday. And to cut a very long story short, I ended up going to a comedy club and I went because I thought I'd go and watch comedy. And when I got to the door, the guy said it's an open mic night. And I genuinely didn't know what open mic meant. And he said, that means that if it's £4 to get in. But if you put your name down and you're prepared to go on stage, you don't have to pay. And I was getting divorced, so I thought, well, that's £4 she's not getting. So I put my name down thinking it'd be 200 people in there, because I'd been to two comedy clubs in my whole life to that point. And I walked in and there was only 7 people. And my name got called out second.
And the 7 people in the audience were also probably trying out as comedians.
Five of them had put the name down. And I remember, and this is no word of a lie, my life would be different, but for a 15-minute window, because... my name got called out second after a guy who got on stage just doing just chicken impressions, just basically saying, if you've ever seen a chicken drive a van, bah, bah,
bah, bah. You think you would have chickened out if you'd been further down the list?
No, I was just, no, look, I'll be honest with you, it looked like care in the community. I thought, I cannot believe these people are here. And then my name got called out. And I walked on stage. I'd never been on stage before in my life. I didn't have a joke in my head. And I remember standing there thinking, what am I doing here? I thought, there's only 7 people. But, you know, if I go back, I'm going back to an empty house. And then I thought, there's only 7 people here. And one of them thinks he's a chicken. So I might as well just stay. And I just started talking. And I remember as well, the light flashes when your time's up in stand-up comedy. I didn't even know that. I remember saying, oh, your light's broke because it was flashing. And I just carried on talking. They ended up playing music to get me off because I was just talking about getting divorced.
And so, yeah, you just made it about real life.
Yeah.
And it resonated with the audience.
Yeah. I mean, when I came off, there was a... the compere was a great comedian called Mick Ferry. And the fellow who run the club said, you know, where have you been doing your comedy? I said, I've never done it anywhere. Because I was meant to do 7 minutes, I think. I did about 35 or something. And he said, you know, you should come back and just do it. It's somewhere to go on a Monday. Just come back and do this. He said, because some of the stuff you were saying was funny. He said, the bit where you spoke about getting divorced and you started crying, don't do that. He said, that's not as funny. But the rest of it, just come back. So just built up from there.
And you kept coming back and honing the set. And then I think you got an opportunity to a main act couldn't do it. You got pulled in and you went to do your act and you realised you had an interesting member in the audience.
Well, yeah, I used to do, I'm trying to work out if this is appropriate. I used to do a joke anyway about splitting up with my wife and then knew I was going to miss her, so I kept her head in the fridge, which is a terrible joke. But I was on stage, I've been caught. Nobody knew I was doing it. I never told any of my friends. I never told anyone I was doing it. It was like my little secret. I didn't tell my mates till I'd been doing it for about over a year. Because when you start off, you're not listed on the lineup. Nobody knows your name. You know what I mean?
Underground,
so,
yeah.
And then I got a phone call to say someone had dropped out. And it was a midweek, so I didn't need to get a babysitter. And I went and I said the same joke about the head being in the fridge. And then I looked and the head was in the audience. And my ex-wife was there. And we were just... In England, when you get divorced, there's a decree, nice eye. It's probably the same here, and then a decree, absolute. And there's like 6 weeks between them. So your divorce papers are in. And then the absolute is when you've just finalised everything. And we were at that stage, and we weren't seeing each other at all. And I saw her. She came over to me at the bar afterwards, and I thought, God. Because when I saw the head, I thought, oh, that's going to cost me another 20 grand. And then she came over and just said that, she was just said it was great to see her. She said, you've got that little twinkle in your eye again, like the man I met. She said, I don't know what happened to you. I said, I married you. That's what happened. And then she just said, do you think we can do something? And do we have to do it this way? And then we started going to Relate, which is like marriage counselling, and got back together.
So you finding your spark, your energy, your calling in comedy also helped you find your way back to your wife and to each other?
Oh, got my family back. I owe comedy more than it'll ever give me back.
And you're married now, how many years?
30 years now. Oh. On and off. But
and kids and happy?
Yeah, listen, we are lucky to have found each other, but even luckier to have hung on.
And one of your biggest fans through the years in the audience was your mum. And I know last year she passed on and you had put up at the time this lovely video of her in the audience watching you perform in Mother Goose. Was she a bit of a character? Did she have your sense of fun and comedy?
She's interesting. My mum seems to be, it's my mum's side of the family that's got the biggest Irish connection. And this whole tour show that I'm doing now is both a love letter to Ireland and a love letter to my mum. And I didn't know it was going to be either of them because I don't write my comedy down. If I'm not performing, I don't sit at home writing jokes. I kind of live my life, hope something funny happens, hope I remember it, and hope it's funny when I tell people. So doing a tour means I just do loads of little gigs and stuff evolves. And what's evolved is this union between the two things. The people of Ireland reflect the way my mum was. She was just funny, friendly, or it's just like everyone's mum, you know what I mean?
And you had three boys.
Yeah.
They used to be part of you.
I don't have three boys. I've got three fellas. Okay. It's three men. I own three men.
They've changed through the years.
Geez. Yeah.
Have they changed you?
Have they changed me?
Yeah. Fatherhood. Did it change you through the years as they go from childhood into teens
if
into 20-something?
If I was to do anything now, if I was to have three wishes, the first wish is I wish I could have them again. I wish I could have them as young children now because I'd be a better dad now because I know more. That would be my first wish.
What would you go back and do different?
I just think... I think I was a young dad, you know, and I knew less about the world than I thought I knew. And also men are more, I'm definitely one of those examples of men being more emotionally in tune than I was. And I think, you know, men don't say I love you very often to a son. If I had a daughter, she'd have been told that every day, but with a son, you don't know what to do, so you just like give him a dead leg or something, have a little wrestle, you can. And I think those things I would be better at now than I was when I was younger.
And you had to go through a lot with one of your sons, if it's okay to ask. I think it was only later in life he got diagnosed with an issue that basically causes deafness over a period of time. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you've kind of learned and grown alongside him as you've learned more about this?
Yeah, well, I mean, we did a documentary about it and it never been spoke about. And like a lot of things in families, when you, particularly if you're in the public eye and your role in the public eye is to make people laugh, when other stuff's not going on well in your life, that's not what, that doesn't get shared. For obvious reasons, also it's private. And also it's not you. You know, your children have their life. And so it's not your role to tell the world what's going on with them. But he lost his hearing when he was 16, and he didn't lose it completely. He's lost 75% of it. It fluctuated up and down, which was very difficult because the fluctuations meant that you couldn't get a benchmark of where to treat it and so on. Anyway, it's sort of settled now that he survives with hearing aids, and we ended up doing this documentary where I learnt enough sign language. We learnt sign language together because he doesn't need it if he's got hearing aids in. We learnt enough sign language together so that I could do a gig to an entirely deaf audience in British sign language.
And as much as he was having to kind of figure out this at age 16, how much for you did you have to adjust and readjust and relearn and rethink even your relationship with your son?
And you never stop doing that. Have you got kids?
Yeah, I have a daughter, age 6. Yeah, it feels like she's going on 16 most days of the week. Yeah, constantly evolving. So,
but your relationship with her will be different in 4 years' time when she's 10 than what you think it will be now. And it'll be different in 10 years' time when she's 16. And it'll be different in 20 years' time. It never ends. And like, you know, my oldest son now, Joe, is 29. And we're probably closer now than we were when he was 16. But when he was 16, he probably needed me to be closer to him then. But I just thought he had a problem. And my job was to try and fix the problem, not ask him how he felt about it. And so we've learned all of those things. And I think as a parent, the biggest challenge is to do the right thing, but also make the person that you're trying to do it for understand why you're doing that. And sometimes that means doing nothing.
And they just feel the love, the loyalty,
yeah, just feel the love.
You had your own health scare recently. You came through it in terms of cancer. Was there, you went to your GP, they took a look at something, you did have this whole moment of contemplating life. Not a period of kind of being, having maybe a test and the test came back. No, maybe not.
No, what I did, this was a long time ago. I haven't had any cancer scare or anything like that. No, a long time ago, when I say a long time ago, I'm talking, must be 10 years ago now, I had a persistent cough. And in the UK, if you've had a cough that doesn't go away for, I think it's 12 weeks, they send you for a chest scan, a chest x-ray. So I had a chest x-ray. This might be what you're referring to. I didn't think I've really spoke about it, but a chest x-ray. And my GP, and I got an all clear, and then about 6 weeks later, the GP phoned me up and said, look, there's been a problem. Can I see? And I went in, and he said, they gave you the all clear by mistake because there's shadows on both your lungs. And he said, you know, that's not good if that's the case. So he said, go, you'll have to get a scan. So fortunately enough, I was able to go and get a CT scan. And what they found out, that is, I've got calcification in the middle of my chest, which means at some point I've broken my what's that part? Your rib cage, the middle of your rib cage. I can't remember what it's called, but I've broken that, and it's rehealed and calcified to a big lump of
your sternum,
bone.
Yeah.
but it looks like a shadow when you put an X-ray on it. Anyway, that period between getting told that you've got something that looks like it's fatal to afterwards was a few days, and I tried to keep it to myself, but because Melanie knows me more than anyone else, she knew straight away, and we went for this thing together. And it's, listen, it's nothing like a lot of people go through, but it was a period of time where you do start going, am I actually, if this was, if I was checking out now, is it okay? Have I done enough? Am I leaving with a settled bill? And it was definitely a time. And I suppose it's led to all of these things, like me thinking, right, I'm now going to learn how to ride a motorbike. I'm going to go touring in different places like America. And I'm going to soak the most out of the day that I can.
So you go through something like that, come out with great health the other side, of course, and you recontemplate and,
But also, I've always tend to be positive. And this is not one of those dramatic things where someone's been through something. You know what I mean? It was very, very mild compared to what other people. It's just that if the prognosis was what the X-ray suggested, then it wouldn't have been very good at all.
What about getting older? Not getting old, but getting older. Like, you're doing the motorbike tour. You did the book, How to Grow Old. Are you enjoying just these later years, getting to do things on your own terms?
I saw a thing the other day, like everybody else now, you pick up your phone and you scroll through something. And Jane Fonda was talking. She's brought a book out, apparently, about feeling better when you're older, because you all of a sudden realise that you life has thrown enough stuff at you for you to know that you can get through it. You know what I mean? You've learned enough and you think, I'll get through this. And so you learn that and you can see all the positives. And also you get bold enough to spend time with the people that you want to spend time with. And so I'm enjoying getting older, apart from the fact that I want more of it.
And more of it and more of Ireland hopefully means you're coming back in October, having done the Atlantic Way. What's up next here?
Well, October, when I come back in October, it will be for this tour, because we've just not been able to have enough tickets for the people to come and see it, because it's gone brilliantly and it's very Irish centric. And then next year will be 25 years from when I did my first ever gig. So I'm going to do a celebration tour of that as well.
Okay, well, we look forward to that. That show that you just mentioned is in the Three Arena on October 5th. It's going to be called Back At It. Tickets are going on sale tomorrow, June 10th at 10 a.m. on ticketmaster.ie. John Bishop, thank you so much for joining us here on the Brendan O'Connor Show.
Thank you. And Brendan, you look a lot better in real life than I was expecting.
Thank you very much. We'll be back after these.
Email Brendan at rte.ie.